Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulip. Today, I'll be examining Russian collusion at the San Francisco Symphony. A guest Russian conductor, a Russian-born guest soloist performing Shostakovich? Shocking. Not really. No special prosecutor needed, just an open ear. I'll have a conversation with conductor Andrei Boreko and violinist Vadim Gluzman as part of this hour. I'll also collude with director, playwright, and actor John Fisher about the world premiere for Theater Rhinoceros' production of Transitions, a satirical drama ripped from the world's headlines about the surprising relationship between a young Republican and a no-nonsense drag queen, in which John Fisher plays both Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. From West Edge Opera, I'll talk with General Director Mark Straczynski, composer Brian Rosen, and conductor Mary Chun, who shared details about West Edge's Snapshot 2018, a showcase of some new unproduced operas. I'll also talk with L.A.-based artist Edgar Arsenault about his project Until, 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 a multimedia video installation and a live-action play that revisits a controversial 1981 performance by American actor, dancer, and singer Ben Vereen, which was televised nationally as part of Ronald Reagan's inaugural celebration. A full hour. Stay with us if you can. Let's start on an operatic note. West Edge Opera's Snapshot presents excerpts from new, previously unproduced operas by West Coast composers and librettists this Saturday and Sunday. It was inaugurated in 2017. The program is the first of its kind in the Bay Area and is a collaboration with Earplay, the new chamber music ensemble. General Director of West Edge Opera, Mark Straczynski, joins me in studio. Mark has created many productions for West Edge Opera and has been on the staging staffs of San Francisco Opera, the Dallas Opera, L.A. Opera, and New York City Opera. He's also directed his own productions for many additional companies and has worked with students at the San Francisco Conservatory, Yale Graduate School of Opera, and the Peabody Institute of Johns Hopkins University. Mark, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks so much for having me.
He's joined by conductor Mary Chun and one of the composers involved in the production, Brian Rosen. Mary, conductor of the new music group Earplay, is a fierce advocate of new works. She's worked with many composers such as John Adams, Olivier Messiaen, Libby Larson, William Kraft, and Tan Dunn, to name just a few. Mary, welcome to you. Happy to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks, David.
And composer Brian Rosen has done a lot of work with Pixar Animation Studios and recently received a grant from the American Composers Forum for the premiere of his song cycle, A Brief History of Love and Poetry. His opera, Death of a Playboy, revolves around a heated discussion, private discussion, that threatens to disrupt Hugh Hefner's funeral. Brian, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, Mark, what a fantastic opportunity to showcase these new works. Brian, just one of several in the production.
Yeah, we started the program last year, and it was really in response to my travels, especially to New York, to experience different new operas that were happening and seeing several programs like this on the East Coast, mostly focused on East Coast composers, and having the question so often, what's out on the West Coast for all the great composers that you have out there? And so I started talking with Brian, actually, last year about creating this program, and we made it happen, and it was a surprising success last year. One of the things that we really loved about it is the comment that we got so often was how entertaining the pieces we picked were. And I think it really both gave an opportunity to show the composers their pieces in action, as well as show our audience how incredibly interesting and vibrant and often accessible, sometimes odd and weird, but the world of new opera is really exciting and vibrant, and we had a lot of people that got even more excited about that from the program last year.
So the challenge must be winnowing down now what to include in a presentation rather than having to search for them.
That's right. Brian actually can talk a little bit about the process because he's been involved. He's only involved as a composer for the first time this year. Last year, he was involved as an administrator and curator and was a major force, as well as Mary, who's here, picking the pieces.
What we try to do is we're trying to get composers to see their work on stage earlier in the process, because many times what happens is composers sort of go and think for months or years about their piece and then sort of deliver something fully formed, expecting it to get produced. What we wanted to do here was to solicit people who are working on things and wanting to try new things and an effort to sort of get them up in a partially baked state to sort of see what they have there. So we opened up the submission process. Last year it was just for Bay Area composers.
Right.
And this year we opened it up for the entire West Coast. And we've seen a lot of, there are a lot of people out there trying to write pieces, and there aren't that many opera companies that are producing pieces. So this is a really useful thing for composers to get their work seen.
Did you have a chance to actually audition folks for these operas, or was that in consultation with Mary and...
Do you mean for the performers or for the performers? We certainly audition people. For the composers, we have a submission process where they send their score and some sample audio tracks so we can evaluate them.
Well, we have to have a little bit of a discussion of your work, especially Death of a Playboy.
So Death of a Playboy is about Hugh Hefner, specifically about his funeral. And it stems from a conversation I had on Facebook, of all places. When Hugh Hefner died, several friends posted things saying, "You go, Hugh, you were one of a kind." And that was a life well lived. And I thought to myself, why are we all of a sudden celebrating this person who did a lot of horrible things to women? He sort of continued the patriarchy.
Well, especially after we just had an hour with Gloria Steinem.
Exactly, exactly. And so I posted on my wall saying, why are we celebrating this person? What's to celebrate? And many of the responses were sort of what I expected. Some guys were saying like, well, you know, he was a product of his time and you have to think about all this. And what I was surprised at was some of my female friends saying, actually, my mom worked with Planned Parenthood and he donated a lot of money and he was very generous and he actually cared a lot about women's issues and he did a lot of good things as well. And so I realized over the course of that conversation that it was actually a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. And that there were legitimate good things that he did and there were a lot of really horrible things he did. And
cared about women, but maybe a little too tactilely.
Exactly, yes. I mean, like, he loved women in good ways and bad ways. And so this piece is actually a conversation about that. It's a conversation about two people who both care very much about women, both the husband and wife, who, you know, she was a playmate, and now she runs a foundation for, you know, empowering women, and she's basically being forced to speak at his funeral, and she hates Hugh Hefner's guts. But she still has to say the nice thing to get the money and do the greater good.
It's composer Brian Rosen, his Death of a Playboy, for which he wrote the music and libretto, are part of West Edge Opera's Snapshot 2018 in collaboration with Earplay New Chamber Music Ensemble, conducted by Mary Chun. Mary, what are the challenges of directing something like Death of a Playboy versus, say, La Boheme?
Well, they're both opera, and they're both on stage, and they're both full of drama, so there's not that many differences. What I want to say, though, before going on about Snapshot is what a wonderful collaboration this has been with Earplay, with West Edge, because what Earplay does in new chamber music, we, you know, basically research and development for all the new composers and live music and, you know, fresh ink, basically. So what we do in Earplay is music from the last decade. And me, as an my other hat I wear as an opera composer, I love working with new opera, and it's a chance for Earplay, our wonderful, talented, you know, virtuosic new music musicians, to get a chance to work in the lyric realm. And that's really something that we don't normally do as concert musicians. So we've been really enjoying a lot the collaboration this last year and this one right now about putting together with the composers and with the singers and with, you know, with me as a conductor. It's been really exciting and really fun.
An embarrassment of riches in terms of the resources you have on hand, especially in the instrumental field. In addition to Death of a Playboy with music and libretto by Brian Rosen, Dynamo with music by Larry London and a libretto by William Smock will be performed. The Last Tycoon, music by Cyril Dekanoff and David Yetzi, based on F. Scott Fitzgerald's unfinished novel, as well as 425 Jamestown Place with music and libretto by Catherine Saxton, and She Who Is Alive by Erling Wald with the libretto by Robert Harris. It's all part of the Snapshot presentation, 2018 West Edge Opera, Saturday and Sunday in Berkeley. Saturday in Berkeley, Sunday in San Francisco, I believe.
That's
more information at westedgeopera.org. Thank you so much for this ever so brief segment. We'll have you on for a longer time when we have more time together.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
We're going to go out with some of the music of Brian Rosen from his Death of a Playboy. Music of Brian Rosen as part of Death of a Playboy to be presented by West Edge Opera. Well, Broadway legend Ben Vereen performed the famous show tune Waiting for Robert E. Lee in blackface as a tribute to legendary vaudevillian Burt Williams during the first act of a specially televised Ronald Reagan Inauguration Gala concert in 1981, which was broadcast live on ABC. Now, during the second act, and the purpose of the blackface was to call attention to racial discrimination, for which Vereen then performed the song Nobody while removing the blackface. But ABC cut that from the broadcast, replacing it instead with a pre-tape number by Donnie and Marie. That omission of the second emancipatory act from national television ruined Vereen's reputation, particularly in the black community. Edgar Arsenault is a Los Angeles-based artist whose drawings, sculptures, and films interrogate how we construct history and memory in a racially divided country. I talked with him earlier this week at his hotel in Union Square. Edgar, thanks so much for taking a little bit of time and talking with us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here. I'm glad that we could do this.
So tell me, why did you feel it necessary to bring this little slice of history back to life?
Well, at first I wasn't certain if it was necessary. You know, I grew up in the 90s in art school, and, you know, identity politics was a big thing then. And one of the things that I told myself as a student was that I was never going to make any art around the subject of blackface, because I felt like it was a polarizing image that was a kind of black hole of symbols that would suck away meaning, because, you know, it forced the viewer into a position in which they had to, you know, engage with it as a like morally. Either they liked it or they didn't like it, or they felt like it was a shameful part of history. But when I ran into the actor Ben Vereen at a kid's birthday party, which I was not invited to, I thought maybe this means something. And I went over and I talked with him, and decided after that first meeting that this story needed to be told.
You actually met with Ben Vereen and viewed the 81 broadcast together. What was that like?
Well, it was surreal for many reasons. One was because he hadn't watched it himself for, you know, at least a decade, maybe two. And when he put it on, we were sitting in his living room together, and he sat down on the floor in front of me watching himself from 30 years prior. And it was a kind of out-of-body experience for me, because I realized that I was sitting behind him watching himself from 30 years before, commenting upon what he used to be able to do. He was like, you know, oh, look at those high kicks. You know, look at my body back then. But then he's performing a man, you know, Bert Williams from, you know, 70 years before that moment. And it was at that point when I realized that there was a bigger question here, which was, when did this performance really begin? And when will it end?
It, on the face of it, it just seems like not such a great idea, performing in blackface to an overwhelmingly white Republican crowd. Now, even with the best of intentions, who would have approved such a thing on either Reagan's or Vereen's end of thing, his people? And but had his entire performance been witnessed, it would have had a whole different perspective. But I still don't think it would have washed well. I mean, did you talk to him about that?
We talked about it. I mean, he when I asked him if he would do it again, you know, with a deep breath, he said yes. But then he also said, you know, I didn't really have any mentors then, you know, someone to say, hey, maybe you shouldn't do this. You know, Frank Sinatra was the producer. He went to Frank Sinatra and said, hey, you know, I want to do something, you know, to make Ronald Reagan aware of the history of civil rights within this country. And he said, sure, let's do it. I mean, the only thing they told him was, you know, make it a few minutes shorter. So he trimmed off 2 minutes. You know, I mean, like Dean Martin was in the audience when he was rehearsing. I mean, you know, there were people there who saw it and, you know, they gave him 2 thumbs up, you know, go for it.
Johnny Carson introduced it.
And I would say, you know, I don't think that it's entirely fair. And, you know, a few decades later to say, hey, you know, it was a bad idea to do it. Because, you know, at the moment, you know, he had just come off of, you know, coming back from Africa with Alex Haley and the whole cast of Roots. And he believed that America was ready to have this conversation. He knew that blackface was polarizing, but he had already performed the show several times on the road, and he had actually done it on television prior to this. So he felt like it had been vetted. But to your original point, you know, would people have accepted it anyway, I think is the other reason why I decided to make this piece. Because I think, you know, powerful art are the ones that force us to constantly rethink ourselves in relationship to it. And I think that that the piece Nobody does that.
As we know, this was devastating to Vereen's career. It took him a long time to recover from that. Now, do you suppose that he was ever able to fully explain himself to the black community? One would think that after the circumstances were detailed, the community would be more enraged with ABC than with Ben.
You would hope so at the time. I mean, there was some victim blaming that was going on there. But, you know, the truth is he never really had the opportunity to tell his side of the story. You know, Frank Sinatra, you know, stopped returning his phone calls. Johnny Carson, who he had begged him, hey, Johnny, let me come on the show, who was a friend of his. You know, they had each other's phone numbers. They would hang out. Johnny Carson wouldn't let him come on the show either. The only person who, according to Ben, that gave him a shot was Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory went on the road. They went on the road together, and he had his opportunity to tell it then. But not on the scale and scope, on a national scale and scope, he's never been able to share that part of his experience.
Did you delve much into the backstory of Bert Williams very much? Fascinating historical character who broke a lot of barriers.
I mean, I've been not as much as I have over the last 2 years since we did the piece. I'm actually trying to turn Tell and So into a feature right now, and I like to spend a significant amount of the movie in the early years of Bert Williams' life. But, you know, I was struck early on by some of the parallels between Ben Vereen's career and Bert Williams. I mean, both of them, you know, are, you know, folks who made their way to L.A. coming out of the, you know, southern parts of the United States to, you know, find stardom. You know, Bert had plenty of controversy in his life and actually wound up performing himself to death at a relatively early age. So I was just thinking more about the parallels of these two actors who were trying to figure out how to engage with politics and also be entertainers at the same time.
I think W.C. Fields referred to him as the funniest man I ever knew and the saddest man I ever met.
Yeah, no, it tends to be right. I came to the conclusion that Bert Williams' depression was tied directly to the fact that he wasn't black in the American sense. I mean, he's Caribbean. But, you know, people never really recognized him for his Caribbean culture. And there's a kind of a class thing there. I mean, many, many Caribbeans will see themselves as being different than black folks and African Americans because they didn't have that same legacy as black Americans did, at least during that time period. So, you know, he had to sacrifice his actual cultural identity, and then he had to learn to perform as a black performer, even though that wasn't actually where he came from. And I think to some degree there was like a double death there, right? So he had to kill the Caribbean side of himself and then wear this blackface makeup. Because he tried to do it as an entertainer before he put on blackface, but it didn't really work.
Actor Frank Lawson has a diverse resume in theater, musical theater. When did you first come across his work, and is he the originating actor for the work?
Yeah, Frank Lawson was a dream to have on the cast. I mean, he tried out for the show, and I liked him immediately, and we did a callback. But what I didn't know is that he had sent me a message on Facebook saying, "Hey, I'm pulling out because I don't think that I can perform as well. I can't dance like Ben Vereen, so you might want to find somebody else." But fortunately, I didn't get the message. And when he came back and he did the audition, I think I realized that this was the kind of person that I wanted to tell this story. He's a fantastic singer, actor, and like he says, he's a person that can move. But he's become a really incredible dancer over the last few years.
Fantastic. This was done in 2015, as you mentioned, but is now the first performances here in San Francisco. And now, after those accusations of inappropriate conduct on Ben's part from that same year in Florida. Mm-hmm. So that raises all kinds of additional questions, I'm sure, with the cast. And
yeah, you know, that original question that propelled me to want to tell the story, which was, when did this performance begin and when did it end? To some degree, you know, we're talking about the cycles of silencing, the cycles of, you know, misuse of power, and that these things can rear themselves oftentimes within the people whom are the victims of such situations. They can find themselves perpetuating it again. You know, so I had to call Ben the same day that all those accusations came out, and I had to talk with him and ask him, you know, what was going on. And, you know, he had his side of the story, but it left us with a conundrum, which is, what do we do? Like, what is our artistic burden? What is our ethical responsibility? And, you know, we had to take a few days, you know, close to a week to figure out, like, hey, can we still tell this story? And it kind of reaffirmed in us that this story was even more important, and that we should figure out how to bring this conversation around what's happening with the Me Too movement into the piece.
Mm-hmm. This is one stop in a tour. Where else are you heading with this?
Well, we're hoping to do a Rust Belt tour. So we're looking to take the piece to as many red and battleground city states and counties as we can. So we're in talks right now to a few places in Ohio, in Detroit, Kentucky, Indianapolis. We're hoping to bring it to Big Car in Indianapolis sometime in the fall. And we're actually actively pursuing being able to do the play in D.C. During midterm elections, which I think would be awesome. But we don't have a venue right now, so if there's anybody out there listening, be in touch.
Hopefully it won't be the Trump reelection gala.
yeah, that's something. You know, it surprises me, you know, to think about that we're back at a place where we never thought we would be again after Obama, but here we are.
I mean, that's the big question. I mean, as a black American, do you think that in 2008, with the election of Obama, that a corner was finally turned in this country? And now, how do you cope with that legacy of his being systematically nulled and voided?
Well, I think, you know, Obama's legacy is being tested, but it's also being, you know, sort of tested within the fires of, you know, the kind of big baptism of the flesh in a way. So I think many of the things that Obama did will, you know, outlast the test that is being put through right now. But it's clear that this administration's mission is based on a platform of undoing as opposed to doing. And my hope is that, you know, people will have enough of that and want to elect some people who will begin to start building on the platforms that that Obama left behind.
Getting the balance back, we hope. Now, this is being combined with the immersive multimedia art installation called Library of Black Lies, a big, large-scale sculpture, and Labyrinth. Now, what sort of lies are we talking about here? Historical, ongoing lies?
Yeah, it's a, you know, the beginning of it is that it's a play on words. I mean, what is a black lie to a white lie? Like, it doesn't really exist. So it sort of forces you to think about that question as you're walking through it. But the Library of Black Lies is both a library and a labyrinth. And for the viewers, you know, and hopefully you'll come and see it, when you walk inside, the walls are made of mirror and, you know, the books make up a maze on the inside. But the difference between mazes and labyrinths is that mazes are designed for you to get lost in, but labyrinths are designed for you to find yourself in the middle. Oftentimes, labyrinths don't have walls at all. So they're meant to be introspective experiences. And so as you're walking through the library, you're also walking through the history of books. And at a certain point, you start to engage like encyclopedias that we grew up with as kids that you and I remember getting like two or three books in the mail. The Encyclopedia Britannica's or the Encyclopedias of Christianity is in there. There's a lot of canonical books. But then in the middle, you have all these books that are covered in sugar crystals. And some of those books are like that were written by Bill Cosby, right? So, like, what do we do with the Cosby Show now after all of the accusations of the crimes, the accusations of crimes by against Bill Cosby? Do we chuck the show away, even though he was America's dad for so many years and so much of us sort of based our lives upon what the Huxtables did? Like, what do we do with that legacy? Within the arc of history that we understand, you know, Black America to be a part of. And that's kind of the bigger idea with the Library of Black Lies is like, how do we explore our shadow side in relationship to the stuff that we actually want to put out there as forward-facing and positive? What do we do with the shadow? Do we run away from it? Do we suppress it? Or do we learn to walk side by side with it?
From what I saw online, you have a really ingenious use of mirrors that almost force the audience to confront their own reaction to what they're seeing or reading for the text.
Yeah, I was thinking about how when you go to a library or a bookstore, for those people who remember what it was like shopping for books in bookstores, sometimes you would pull a book off a shelf and then you might see somebody's face on the other side. And that could be a little bit jarring. But, you know, when you're walking through stacks of books, sometimes you'll see somebody's feet in another person's head, so you can feel a little bit disconnected. You know, so getting lost is oftentimes how we learn things. And I wanted the experience of being inside of the Library of Black Lies to be reminiscent of how we actually learn.
One of my first questions should have been, let's make it my last question, the title, Until.
Yeah, it's about longing. It's a desire for resolve. For something better in a future that you can't necessarily describe, one that you don't know necessarily what it's going to look like, but the hope remains anyway. It's a lingering, a longing for some sort of resolve, although you're not quite certain where it is and when it's going to happen.
You'll be at the Centre Pompidou in Paris in March. What are you mounting there?
We're doing some programming. We're going to be teaching young French and American kids living in France how to make movies. They're going to be taking big blockbuster films like E.T. and Poltergeist and some contemporary stuff and remixing it to figure out how to take the politics that exist in the background of popular entertainment and bring it to the foreground. So they'll be taking those movies, they'll be cutting them up, shooting their own footage, and then telling new stories.
Paris in the springtime. I don't think it can go wrong there. I hope you enjoy in San Francisco in the wintertime, and we look forward to the performances here.
Yeah, an artist's life is terrible. I don't know what I did wrong to deserve all that.
The live performance part of Until by Edgar Arsenault will be performed tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday, and the accompanying exhibit through Sunday at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco,
ybca.org for more information. Here's a taste of the great Burt Williams and the song that wasn't heard on ABC, Nobody. Next on Open Air, well, a surprising relationship between a young Republican and a no-nonsense drag queen almost sets the world on fire in this satirical drama ripped from the world's headlines in the tradition of filmmakers Billy Wilder and Oliver Stone. It's written by the Energizer Bunny of Bay Area Theater with too many awards and accolades to list now, but we have in the past. It's John Fisher, who joins me once again in studio. Welcome, John.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
Well, one of those accolades I should mention is that you were winner of the Best Actor Award for your one-man show, A History of World War II, at the United Solo Festival 2017 in New York City. Congratulations on that.
Thanks a lot.
So, obviously the inspiration for the show is drawn from contemporary headlines, but how are you presenting this in a way that's going to be both entertaining and enlightening?
Well, it's really a story of Trump and Putin and their relationship, which I think is incredibly complex, obviously, but also very dangerous. I've written it in the spirit of these kind of doomsday movies like Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, where the world is on the brink. And I really do think that's where we're headed. The doomsday clock, as you know, is 2.5 minutes to midnight, closer to midnight than it's ever been. And I don't think that's really about environmental issues. They say that. I think it's about nukes. Mm. I think it's about all the sword rattling going on in the world. And this is what this play is about. I mean, it starts out as sort of a lark. It's a lot of fun. And then it gets pretty dark and pretty exciting. And at the center of it is an individual who smooths the way to a resolution. But really, it's a cautionary tale because I think we live in an extremely dangerous time. And that's what I have felt lately. It's weird. I read this in 2017, this play. And then in the beginning of the year, 2018, I was in Hawaii.
And
I was
there.
Yeah, yeah. I was there for the alert notification that missiles were headed our way. And my whole life, I'm 54, I've lived in fear of this. I grew up with it, watching these old movies, being terrified of it. And I guess a part of my brain had decided, well, it's never really going to happen in my lifetime. And all of a sudden, here it was. And for 30 minutes, my husband and I were convinced that was it. Not just of us, but probably of the species, knowing the personalities involved. And the worst thing about it was it all made sense. North Korea, Trump, it just everything made sense. It never crossed my mind that this was a mistake.
Wow.
And for 30 minutes, I was like, it all computes. It is happening. Of course, they said seek shelter. There's no shelter. We're not prepared for any of this.
So how did you process that?
I didn't. Michael and I went into slow motion. I decided I was in a towel because I'd just gotten out of the shower. I thought, well, I should get dressed. That took 15 minutes. I couldn't find my socks. I mean, I dressed in like 30 seconds. I was like dumb. And Michael said, well, we should turn on the TV. That took 15 minutes.
Well, let's just duck and cover.
Yeah, yeah, we were just not. And then finally he turned the TV on, and it was CBS, and it was basketball. And I said, change the channel. And he changed the channel. It was like soccer or something. And we're like, wait a minute, maybe it is a mistake because nobody's covering this.
How did you personally get the notification?
On my phone.
On your phone.
And 2 years ago, I didn't know what a push notification was. Now I know what they are, and they're correct when I see one on my phone. So that was another thing. It's like that's how the world's changed. It's like if your phone tells you something, you know, you believe it. And it said, you know, ballistic missile is headed this way. Seek shelter. This is not a drill. So, I'm not usually a prescient playwright. I'm not usually a playwright that sees the future. But I was like, oh, my God, this is what I just wrote a play about. And then, of course, it was not really the case. And we were told, the radio told us, well, it was just a mistake. Go proceed with your holiday weekend plans. Aloha. That was the resolution.
Wow.
Go ahead with your holiday weekend. And I was like, how?
And take the heart out of your throat and...
Heart of my throat. And I thought, this is it. I mean, this is it for all of us. It's, you know, it's going to turn into On the Beach. It's going to be nuclear clouds and the species is dead and we've finally done it. And so the play really is about what I think is a very dangerous position we're in now with Korea and China and Russia and ourselves and our president and their president. I think we're in an era of fascism. I think we have fascist rulers in the world. And the last time this happened was 1930s. And we see where that ended up. And, you know, we talk about, you know, I think mentally we think, well, it's okay because...
Just for now, yeah, it's going to be, we're going to be over it soon or...
Yeah, or Trump is somehow in Putin's pocket. And, you know, it's like if Trump is appeasing Putin, we see where that leads because Britain appeased Hitler. It doesn't work. There are tensions in this world that need to be addressed with finesse and delicacy and diplomacy, and we don't have diplomats anymore. Hmm. We have people who rattle swords and play with our lives.
Plutocrats more than anything else.
Yes, and you know, it's going to be the missiles of October all over again, where we have leaders basically, you know, trying to prove things to each other at our expense. Hmm. We are the poker chips. So the play really is about that. And
so you're looking at this, given that when you wrote this and then after this, Hawaii, is this sort of theater as therapy to help you process through this? What are you hoping what the audience are going to be? Are going to be entertained? Are they going to be enlightened? Or
I really think of warned? It as like Failsafe or Dr. Strangelove. I think it's two different approaches, one very dramatic, one very comic, but both with the same purpose. We really need to think about things. And we have to think globally, and we have to stop thinking so parochially about things, and we have to realize that we have in our grip the processes to change, but we have to be active. We can't be complacent. I think a lot of us Democrats were very complacent about Hillary Clinton getting elected, and we relaxed. And we have to get motivated. We have to, you know, we have to change things. No, I don't. This isn't therapy. It's not despair. It's a warning. And you know, the person who is the hero of the play is a drag queen, and I think often that people on the edges of society have a perspective that can lend itself to a situation like this. Another hero of the play, and this is where I might get in trouble, but a voice of reason within the White House is Melania Trump. So that character begins to exert an influence on her husband at the crisis moment, which helps to resolve the issue.
And Donald, come to bed.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, she's a very interesting character in the White House, a very evasive, opaque individual. It's hard to get a handle on her. And I think maybe that's where I'm going to get myself there's going to be some controversy about this play, is because I'm not just dismissing her as some trophy second wife who doesn't have a mouth. You know, I utilize her as a character.
I thought it was third wife, actually, but I'm not sure.
It's probably 15th, for all we know. Yeah. So I utilize her as a catalyst for change, and that's sort of my hope, or sort of my unique perspective being a dramatist.
Mm-hmm. So you're playing both Trump and Putin in this production.
Yes, to make the point that they are one and the same, and to give myself some more acting challenges.
And tell us about the rest of the cast, then.
I've this amazing actress, Katie Rubin, who I just love, plays Melania, and Ludmila Putin. She's too funny. I mean, she just nails these women in a very comic but human way. She somehow humanizes them, and her relationship with her son is extremely moving, I think. Baron, she calls him, Baron Trump. And Charles Peoples plays the drag queen. He played one of the drag queens in our production of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And he plays a very different drag queen in this, a drag performer. And he's just incredible on stage presence. So I've got a terrific cast. They're a real pleasure to be on stage with and to work with. And three other actors who I just adore, Catherine Wood, who I've done a bunch of projects with. She's sort of the villain, the Republican evil mistress, orchestrating everything. So it's a really strong group of people.
The play is Transitions by John Fisher, written by John, and acting as both Trump and Putin in the production. It's at therhino.org for more information, at the Gateway Theater, formerly the Eureka Theater, and that is at 215 Jackson Street. Therhino.org for more information. John, I think you will survive this.
and I hope we all do.
And many more.
I hope we all do.
The productions run through March 17th. Again, more information at therhino.org for Transitions by John Fisher. John, always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, David. It's a pleasure.
Well, the Russians indeed are coming. They've actually arrived, and I don't believe a special prosecutor is needed, though. Guest conductor Andrei Boreko will lead the San Francisco Symphony in Dmitri Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, and the orchestra will conclude its Bernstein Centennial Tribute with his Divertimento for Orchestra and the Serenade, a full violin concerto, really, with guest violinist Vadim Gluzman, which was inspired by Plato's Symposium. Yesterday, I caught up with both artists in their Davies Symphony Hall dressing rooms.
Maestro, welcome to Open Air.
Good evening. Good morning. I don't know.
Good day, Woodwork.
Good day. Glad to be here.
Well, I don't know if you've been listening to American news. You can probably not avoid American news, but do we have to involve a special prosecutor like Robert Mueller here to examine this obvious Russian collusion between you and our soloist in the symphony?
Well, I try to avoid any political news, but if you think that Prosecutor Mueller was just thinking about us, I have to read it. Probably I have to go now and listen to this news.
Have you collaborated with Vadim before?
Oh, many times. We met first times about probably six, seven years ago, maybe even more, eight. And we did many concerts together. We played a classical repertoire. We played romantic, modern, Shostakovich, very modern. So I know him.
I mentioned to Vadim that this is a work from 1953, the same year he wrote Wonderful Town, all kinds of musical theater influences, as well as it was a time where he decided to take a year off from conducting and just devote to conducting. To composing. And yet, because of the amazing mind that is Bernstein, there's lots of different things going on. Is it hard for you to assemble this pastiche into a through line, one work?
Well, first of all, we are in the centennial year of Leonard Bernstein, and all the world is celebrating his 100 years centennial. And I guess that as a composer, he is a little bit undervalued, and I'm very glad to play his music because everybody knows him as a conductor, first of all, as a pianist, also as an educator working with a young audience, yes, as a wonderful, charming person, of course. But since I'm interested in his music, in his life, and I met his daughter also, I know his music quite well, and I played some of not many, but quite many pieces of him. I think that his music is really a wonderful example of combination of a modern musical language with a classical tradition and roots, traditions and roots. That's why, for me, Leonard Bernstein in a certain way is like Leonardo da Vinci in a art, so universal man who could do so many things, and everything what he did, what he was doing, was really on the very high level.
He mentioned himself in his writings later in life that he feels these different directions are going off because he'd never had a large period of time that he either could or had the opportunity to devote strictly to composing.
Well, what about Gustav Mahler? In certain way, you know, Bernstein once said that he feels himself like a reincarnation of Gustav Mahler. And I believe, you know, that it's, who knows, maybe it's true, because there are so many things connecting both to wonderful musicians. And I guess we do have many examples of the conductors who were composing, and they were, as a composer, they were undervalued at the time when they were still conducting. And if we recall the Mahler, who died at the beginning of 20th century, actually his music became very popular and known in the middle of the 20th century and then the second part of the 20th century. So Bernstein was living the life of the artist who is traveling, performing the music of other composers. So composition for him, it was a sort like to escape from this everyday's world. He did, as far as I know, he didn't have such small houses like Mahler did have when he was composing in the Alps in Austria. Mm-hmm. But he used any chance to spend weeks or months composing again and again until the very end of his life. I think that the time of his music is already there, but I believe that his music will be performed even in 50 years and in 100 years. So that's mean for me, as a composer, Leonard Bernstein is part of the musical history of our human mankind.
Of course, the Mahler comparison is apt because his interpretation of Mahler is amazing. Yeah. And I think, like Mahler, the critics criticized Mahler, saying the conductor should stay on the conductor and not compose, and that's similar to the criticisms of Bernstein.
Exactly, the criticism which he had, especially in the time when he was music director of the New York Philharmonic, was huge and very often not fair towards him, and I can imagine how painful it was for him. But you know, we all live in a world where some people likes what we are doing, some people don't. We need to know how to behave, and I think that Bernstein found also the very, very good way, maybe to ignore sometimes, maybe to not to react, maybe just not to to read what the people are writing about his interpretation and the concerts. You know, it was a beautiful story about Jean Sibelius when he was 19 years old. One journalist came to him for the long interview, and at the end of this interview he asked him, what do you think about the name of the Finnish journalist? He was all his life writing only bad reviews to the Sibelius music, all really his life, never ever something good. And it was a year when in Finland, in Helsinki, in the capital of Finland, they just opened the beautiful new monument to the Sibelius. Sibelius was still alive, but the monument was there. And Sibelius was saying, you know, young man, you asking about the reviews, about the critics. Have you ever seen the monument to any critic, musical critic? And it was beautiful answer. So actually, some people are they can write whatever they like, but some other people, they are part of our musical history and life. And well, we say in Russia, sometimes the dogs are barking, but the caravan is moving.
Do you have a favorite Leonard Bernstein anecdote of either your personal interaction with him or a story that you'd like to share?
Well, it was one, but quite long story. I met him only once, but it's quite long story. I don't think that we have enough time for that. But once when I met him in St. Petersburg, in Leningrad, it was still Leningrad, it was 1 year before he died. And I met him, I decided to introduce myself as a young conductor and ask him to help me with a Tanglewood application, because it was for me just absolutely impossible to pay entry fee, which was about $400. But in this time, it was for me like $4 million now, probably bucks. It was absolutely unimaginable number of money. And I met him and I talked to him. He promised me to help. And it was very nice conversation. And I was really I believed that he would do it, but he passed away just a few months after that. So it was... Maybe I could have been one of his last pupils, but from other side, we are speaking now here in San Francisco. I'm working in the United States, even without Tanglewood. So maybe he did help me from the cloud number 9, but not as a teacher in a person, but with some ideas, thoughts through the mental world.
Indeed. You've recorded an extensive discography, and among your Shostakovich symphonies, you recorded the 1st, the 4th, the 6th, the 8th, the 9th, the 15th on Hensler Classics, but not the 5th.
Yes, I did.
You have?
Yes, okay. The recording appeared 2 years ago.
Okay, good. I've got some bad information there. But a similar question that I asked our soloist, do you feel here a fundamental difference between playing Shostakovich with Russian orchestra versus an American orchestra?
Not really, because all the background of this music and all the biography of Shostakovich, which probably Russian orchestras knows better, and musicians in Russia knows better about his life and the background of this symphony particularly. But I can always tell a few words to the American or Japanese orchestra about it. Most important, it's not knowing everything in all details, what was the reason of this music, why it has been composed, and what was around him. Most important, the quality of the playing. Shostakovich music required very, very high-level orchestra. And with all my respect and, of course, my sentiment to the Russian orchestras and Russian musicians, there are not so many very high-level orchestra in Russia in compared with United States. So playing it in Russia, I can just name you five, six orchestra in Russia which are able to play it on the same level like in United States, probably 10. So it's not a big difference. And this week is another example because I just told them a few things. I told the musicians of the wonderful San Francisco Symphony, I told them a few things they didn't know. You couldn't find it in internet. It's not in the books. I heard it from my professor, my teacher, who studied with Shostakovich, and so he knew many, many things about it. So I told them, and they appreciated it very much. They liked it very much. But the level of the preparation, level of the listening to each other's, of controlling the musical process of the colors, it was so high from the beginning, even without this information. So I don't think that music needs to be explained. Music must be performed on very high level, and you need just great musicians. Doesn't matter where they live.
Well, you've got a good bunch here, and I'm looking forward to seeing your interpretation of not only the Bernstein but the Shostakovich, and hope you have a wonderful stay in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking some time. Looking forward to the concerts.
Me too. I wish you all the best. Thank you.
Vadim Glizman, welcome to Open Air, and thank you for taking some time after your rehearsal.
My pleasure.
That was a spectacular rehearsal that I just witnessed part of for the Bernstein Serenade. Now, why do you suppose Bernstein ultimately named this a serenade instead of what is really a violin concerto and what he himself referred to as a violin concerto while he was composing it?
Well, I think partly it has to do at least with the theme of it, love. And I think Serenade would be the perfect name for a piece that is written on the subject of love. And of course, at the same time, if you listen to it, you realize it's one of his most lyrical works. So it is indeed a very fitting name. Mm-hmm. I really wouldn't argue.
Well, he could have called it a symposium because it's based on Plato's Symposium. And in fact, even though he said he didn't want people to think of it as having a program per se, he went on to provide some very specific program notes for each of the movements. Do you think of those program notes as you're performing the piece, or is it more your own interpretation of the themes as they come to you?
Well, two reasons why not. One, I personally think that music in general is the most abstract form of art. And I think giving music a program narrows it tremendously. So maybe this is just my personal perspective. Also, I know from Isaac Stern, who premiered the piece, for whom it was written, when discussing it with Bernstein, he asked him how much one should pay attention to the program notes and how much should one pay attention to Plato's Symposium. And Bernstein, being himself, said, "Oh, just think of love." As funny as it is, this gives me the starting point for this music. Just think of love. Love is so many different things for all of us, and it is the most universal, the most mysterious subject that has been searched for, longed for as long as humans are humans. So I think to me this is much more inspiring rather than narrowing it down just to this one symposium, which is an absolutely incredible piece. And yes, there are parallels. Having said all of that, there are parallels and there are those descriptions that Bernstein himself has written, but he said himself that one should not take it too literally. Mm-hmm.
Well, I hear, I'm not as familiar with the work as some of other Bernstein's pieces, but I hear a lot of Bernstein's pieces in this work, as I suppose the more you discover a composer, the more you hear some of these themes. For instance, this is from 1953. He wrote Wonderful Town in the same year. The year before, he wrote Trouble in Tahiti. West Side Story would come in a few years. I hear a little bit of Chichester Psalms in there.
Absolutely. There are a number of motifs that haven't arrived yet, but they are there. There is a clear motif of Maria that mm-hmm. will come later yeah. In the West Side Story. There are a number. I don't want to give it up, but it's. I think the nucleus of his language is all there in this piece, and he himself said that this was his best serious work. I don't disagree.
Well, it is the most recorded work of his serious works. You yourself recorded this with John Neckling, conducting the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra. You just performed this with the BBC Symphony last month, and you're going to do this again in April in Dallas. Are you hearing different things with American orchestras than you hear with other orchestras?
Well, you know, world is such a small village nowadays. Not anymore. I have to say, BBC Symphony in London, they were as American as swing itself. They were absolutely fantastic. I think it has to do with openness and experience and exposure to different musical languages. Some other orchestras in Europe maybe weren't as comfortable, but by the first concert, we all arrive to the destination point.
Tell us about the extraordinary instrument you have the pleasure of playing on.
I've been playing this violin for over 20 years now. As my wife says, this is the only other woman she will tolerate. It's a violin built by Antonio Stradivari in 1690. It belonged to the great Russian pedagogue Leopold Auer, and it is nicknamed after him. It's called the X Auer. So for this instrument, Tchaikovsky Concerto was written, and on this instrument it was rejected as unplayable. This instrument premiered Glazunov Concerto. It played for the first time all the famous solos in Tchaikovsky ballets, the Nutcracker, Swan Lake, you name it. It was all written for Auer, who was the Tsar's violinist, not only professor at St. Mm-hmm. Petersburg Conservatory. That was his job, to walk into the pit during the ballet performance, stand on a little podium, play his solo, and leave. He was not part of the orchestra. This violin was heard by young Yasha Heifetz, Nathan Milstein, Misha Elman, etc., etc. It's inspiring. It is awe-inspiring.
Other than its history, what is it about the sound that you hear in it?
Well, after so many years, it is the sound. When I think violin, I think sound of this violin. I think to me it is incredibly human, yet it is incredibly even in all the registers. You will easily mistake it for viola when I play on in the lower register on G string, and it has a wonderfully, it maintains wonderfully warm and open sound to the top register, which is very often, even with greatest violins, you have this shrieking quality. That is not the case with this fiddle. But don't listen to me. I'm not objective. Just listen to the violin.
This will be, throughout this year, you know, the celebration of Bernstein. I've had multiple segments with people that have been involved with Bernstein Productions. And everyone seems to have a Leonard Bernstein story or an anecdote. You shared the one about Isaac Stern premiering the piece. I'm wondering if you had a chance to ever meet Bernstein, or you know of a particular anecdote that you'd like to share about Leonard Bernstein.
Well, I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but I've experienced something that will stay with me for the rest of my life. My family came to Israel from Soviet Union in September of 1990, and at the end of September, and I think mid-October, we were attending for the first time a concert of Israel Philharmonic. I was 16 at the time, and before this concert, Avi Shoshani, who is the director general of the Philharmonic, came on stage and announced that Leonard Bernstein passed away last night in New York. I have never seen before or after over 2,000 people in tears. This was really, for a, now thinking back, we were this is almost 30 years ago. This was an incredible impression on a young man. Of course, I knew who he was at the time, but the story of him and Israel Philharmonic and Israel in general. To say he was a darling is a humongous understatement. He was there at every rough corner that the country has ever seen, playing concerts for the troops, playing concerts for the evacuees. He was really part of the fabric of the society. And to see that an artist could be beloved that much, this was really something very special. And the moment my the English came to use, I started reading about him, and ever since he's been a fascination.
And as I mentioned, you'll be doing this piece again in April in Dallas. Any other Bernstein on your programs coming up?
Yes, I'm bringing to Europe once again this season to Belgrade, and that would be the end of Bernstein season in this year. Yes.
My conclusion of the conversation with violinist Vadim Gluzman. The concerts are tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 8 p.m. sfsymphony.org for more information.